are listening to the Star Lores Podcast.
I find your lack of faith disturbing.
Why, you stuck up, half-witted, scruffy-looking nerf herder!
But I was going into Toshi Station to pick up some power converters.
In the endless road of genetic diversity, certain patterns begin to emerge. Optimization, or the ability to provide flexibility in the face of environmental stressors, serve to mold features that are sometimes replicated. Amidst the staggering types, shapes, and sizes of organic life that populate millions of worlds, some patterns begin to emerge. Of the endlessly diverse ways life can develop, look, and function, one has proven itself to be at least somewhat successful template by which many species have come to match.
Humans, near humans, and humanoids. Humans make up one of the greatest proportions of sentient species in the galaxy. Their influence is unmatched, and their characteristic size and shape has largely become the default of intergalactic civilization. From the size and shape of starships and buildings to the very concept of near human being used as the basis to define the genetic similarity between humans and other species. Humanity has left its mark from the largest star systems to the smallest strands of DNA. Despite the diversity that exists within the human species, from variations of skin, eye, and hair colors, fundamentally, all humans share distinct characteristics that separate them from other species from across the galaxy. And yet, so many others have come to resemble humans in many ways, from the purely aesthetic similarities, all the way to completely distinct biological entities with only a passing visual similarity. Humans are a distinct species with a genetic lineage, known for their large brains, bipedal nature, and a host of biological features. Two eyes, a nose, two ears, etc. And most of all, their adaptability. Near humans are xenos, or human genetic offshoots, who have become their own distinctive species, but whose roots remain in or come from humanity. Responding to ecological pressure, artificial interference, or a host of other factors, near humans are variants of humanity that share in their genetic pool. Something seen as close to as a variant or subspecies of humanity. Interbreeding between baseline humans and near humans was also much easier due to their shared genetic heritage, though it did not depend on the exact nature of the near human. Humanoids, by contrast, are completely foreign biological entities that may, though chance or similar environmental pressures that shaped humanity, only share similarities with humans, either aesthetically or otherwise. While biology often lacks hard barriers, near humans often escape the more severe forms of interspecies bigotry, sometimes being able to blend in their regular humans, though this depended on how far from baseline humanity their form took. Though some extremists and genetic purists would still look down on and ostracize near humans for their differences rather than recognizing their similarities. Humans lack a monoculture, and their diaspora spread across the galaxy for thousands of years across many worlds, have adapted separately and evolved culturally and even biological differences, speciating and becoming something different. BIM.
BIM were diminutive near humans that, not to be confused with the furred mammalian BIM species that share a name and homeworld, who grew no taller than 1.5 meters tall. Outwards, they appeared much like humans, standing only as tall as human children when fully grown. BIMs lived tranquil lives in 4 cities on their homeworld. The BIM's most unique trait was cultural. Having migrated to the planet Bimisari, where they encountered a native sentient marsupial-looking species who also called themselves BIM. The two groups instantly began sharing and merging their cultures, so that the two groups were indistinguishable, despite their outward biological differences. The two groups had so seamlessly merged that most galactic inquiries refer to BIMs mutually and culturally as the same, and near-human BIMs have intermarried with their furry counterparts. However, their genetic incompatibility means they cannot produce offspring. BIMs were pacifists by nature, and their language, Bimini, was melodic, sung rather than spoken. BIMs were avid storytellers, musicians, artists, and preferred and preserved a simple life. Their culture was harmonious and peaceful, forbidding weapons and shunning offworlders who came armed. The BIM admired and highly respected the Jedi, and even allowed them to carry their lightsabers. Most BIMs seen across the galaxy were merchant traders, scholars or artists, or otherwise lived in BIM enclaves on alien worlds, though some adventurous rogues were known to brave the galaxy as well. Bimistari's remote location and inconsequential nature have left it relatively unmarred by the many wars that have plagued the galaxy. It was a wild and temperate world with large forests and jungles. It was known as a center for trade and would often take on refugees from war-torn planets. The BIM were brought to the brink of extinction by the Ozon Vong invasions, though they managed to survive and return their world to rebuild.
Zeltron. Hailing from the planet Zeltros, found in the Inner Rim, Zeltrons are identifiable by their bright pink to deep red colored skin and red or blue colored hair. Zeltrons are known to be very attractive to humanoids and even some non-humanoid species, thanks to their physical appearance, as well as a pheromone that they emitted that made them even biologically amiable, similar to that of the Phalene species. Zeltrons also had telepathic abilities, which allowed them to project or read the emotions of others. They were thought to be very gullible and naive by others. Furthermore, Zeltrons had a second liver, which further enhanced their ability to ingest intoxicants and had highly efficient metabolisms, which made them able to eat more while maintaining toned and fit figures. Zeltros is a luxurious world of hedonism and revelry, largely due to their telepathic abilities, which caused most Zeltrons to want to enhance and maintain their states of happiness and pleasure and avoid negative emotions such as fear and sadness. The planet would become a popular vacation destination, which many found difficult to leave after being immersed in the careless party atmosphere and pheromones of the population. More than one planetary invasion had even been stalled due to these mind-altering celebratory effects. This produced a cultural milieu of pleasure-seeking and partying, leading to negative stereotypes of laziness and thrill-seeking. Zeltros itself was brightly colored in neon pink, and blues and exotic architecture dotted its surface. Its major exports being art, high technology, luxury goods, and entertainment, and was governed by an elective monarchy. Culturally, Zeltrons were very lascivious, producing art and literature dedicated to carnal pursuits. They were not often monogamous by nature, and usually dressed in bright colors and patterns and skin-tight and revealing clothing. While they preferred a good time, they could also become excellent warriors if pressed into combat. And despite its reputation for leisure, Zeltros maintained an active and fierce military. The world lacked planetary shielding and was prone to invasion and vulnerable to orbital bombardment. And that.
The Anzati, or Anzat singular, were a long-lived near-human species known for their ability to detect the Force and eat the brains of their victims. They had slightly greenish-tan skin, bulbous noses, and two tentacles that extended from their cheeks that they used to feed on brain matter, but could otherwise be retracted, making them almost indistinguishable from other humans. Anzati could live eons and sustain themselves on feeding from the life force of others. They preyed on other sentients and were largely driven by their hunger, attracted to hunting those that gave off strong force energy and vitality, or luck as the Anzati saw it. Anzati used a mesmerizing mind control ability to hypnotize and enthrall their prey, drawing them close where they could uncoil their face tentacles and sent them up the nostrils of their victims to get at their brain and life essence, which the Anzati referred to as soup, or luck, or the sea of memory for the latter. Anzati would feed on both the physical brain as well as the life energy of the victim, and could keep a person alive from multiple feedings, relishing the fear and agony they would experience. However, weak-willed victims of lower constitution and vitality were no more than a snack or scrap, and would often succumb to their first and only feeding. Jedi were often regarded as a great prize for an Anzati to hunt, their life force and strong presence providing a rare and satisfying meal. Culturally, the Anzati focused on satisfying their hunger, driven to hunt and feast. As they grew older, they would need to feed more, often becoming isolated and obsessive over their hunt, and regarded other beings as little more than livestock to be harvested. Despite this, their long lives made them able and talented individuals through virtue of experience, and many Anzati appreciated art in many of its mediums, from music to books to paintings, but did not think much of mastering any one form as much of an accomplishment, and were mere diversions from their main instinctual drive. Anzati do not procreate often, returning to their homeworld to mate. They do not name their youth, preferring them to adopt names from populations they would infiltrate to better blend in with their prey, who they prefer to live amongst in secrecy, hiding amongst their victims while quietly practicing their grim trade and living nomadically, moving from population group to population group. They would often find work as bounty hunters and assassins, particularly for crime bosses in the underworld, where they could subsist and sharpen their hunting and tracking skills. Anzati were more often than not loners, though they could form temporary groups to hunt in packs, though this practice was uncommon and broke down rather quickly. There exists a subgroup of feral Anzati, who appear far more bestial, with mouths full of sharp fangs and clawed hands, and are incapable of speech beyond single words or short phrases, and exist in a much more primal state. Anzati have a mythical reputation amongst many species, some believing them no more than legends. This mystery is compounded by their homeworld, Anzat, which has evaded thorough study, and its location is only broadly thought to be in the Midrim, near the Perlimnian trade route. Explorers and scientists who have attempted to study the world often disappear without a trace, along with their findings.
Arcanian. Deep in the region of space known as the Colonies, the frozen planet of Arcania, rich in resources, particularly precious gems, diamonds, and minerals, the world was home to a unique near-human species known as Arcanians. They were masters of biological manipulation and could live up to 100 years on average. Their eyes were milk white, and they could see in the infrared spectrum. They had pale skin and white hair. They would often tamper with genetics and cybernetics, creating a series of subspecies that they called Arcanian offshoots, who varied slightly in their appearance to their more pure-blooded counterparts, and were usually bred as subservient, task-oriented, and disposable menials. Arcanians were known for their intelligence, which they in turn contributed to a sense of self-importance, causing them to look down on others as somewhat inferior. Arcanians were able to memorize libraries worth of information single-handedly, calculating advanced and complex mathematics that could rival supercomputers. The natural resource of their world, which the Arcanians harvested, processed, or otherwise exported, made their society very wealthy to match their arrogance. One such corporation that was a result of Arcanian wealth and biological ingenuity was the Adaska Biomechanical Corporation of Arcania, or ADSCorp for short. The company was run by one of the wealthiest noble Arcanian families, whose hubris led them to try to manipulate both the Mandalorians and Republic during the Mandalorian Wars, but ended with disastrous consequences. Arcanian society is organized by noble houses and blood lineage, and Arcanian prize academic and scientific pursuits and achievements. Their focus of genetics, lineage, and purity has led to more than one purge of offshoot breeds of that. Offshoot species were often the result of mixing Arcanian genetics with other Xenos, resulting in various differences. From human-like eyes with pupils and irises, to five-fingered hands and pointed ears. These offshoots were often bred to perform manual labor and tasks that purebloods saw as beneath them, and on occasion, offshoots were purged when they or their purpose became obsolete. The Arcanians have been censured many times for their immoral genetic practices, often having been found to tamper with the genetics of neighbors and other species without oversight or consent. Arcanians are known to collaborate with the Empire in the development of biological weapons, and were even barred from joining the New Republic. Some notable Arcanians are Arca Jeth, a famed Jedi Master during the Old Sith Wars, who is a credit to his species as one of the greatest Jedi of his era, and era known for great Jedis. He taught many students, and his talent with the Force, the lightsaber, and his wisdom was second to none. Arco Adaska was the CEO of ADSCorp during the Mandalorian Wars and attempted to seize control of the galaxy by weaponizing Exogorists. He was a member of one of the greatest Arcanian noble houses and met his end with the destruction of their family flagship and headquarters after his plans failed, bankrupting the family as well. Jareel and Gorman Vandrake were two prominent Arcanian offshoots who escaped indentured servitude from ADSCorp. and became companions, and in Jareel's case, lover, of the infamous Jedi Padawan, Zane Carrick. Mira Luka.
Mira Luka were a Force-sensitive species that looked human in every way except for their notable lack of eyes. To make up for their lack of traditional vision, Mira Lukans developed keen Force sight and were able to perceive the world through the Force, sensing strong and weak signatures, as well as alignment of light, dark, or neutral proclivities. Despite the lack of eyeballs, Mira Luka still had vestigial eye sockets, but often would cover them with ornate headwear or decorative jewelry. Because their species was overall Force-sensitive, many were known to join the Jedi or the Sith, though Mira Lukans had developed their own Force-based religion, as well as where they worshipped the binary gods Bo'Gan and Ashla, and did not believe in good or evil, but both as inevitable states of being. Mira Luka came from an unnamed homeworld that had been destroyed by its naturally decaying atmosphere, forcing the species to migrate to the world of Alfiridaeus, a temperate agrarian world. The planet had changed hands many times through its history, having been conquered by the Sith and Mandalorians, and liberated by the Jedi at various points in time. It was after the migration to this world that Mira Luka began to gradually lose their sight due to their local red dwarf star. Most Mira Luka lived simple lives and did not often venture into the galaxy unless by joining the Jedi or Sith, or otherwise as wanderers and nomads. Some colonies were known to exist on other planets, such as Katar. Mira Lukans valued family bands and saw their entire species as an extended family. The Mira Luka people suffered greatly at the time of the Jedi Purge, and many were either slaughtered or forced to serve the Empire as Inquisitors and Force Adepts. Some notable Mira Luka are Visas Mar, who hailed from the Katar colony before it was destroyed and consumed by Darth Nihilus, and was one of its only survivors, being taken on as a Sith apprentice. She would eventually find her way to the light and become the informal apprentice of the Jedi exile Mitra Sirik. Jarek was a notable Mira Lukan Imperial Inquisitor and former Jedi and archaeologist. Jarek sought the Valley of the Jedi after the first death of Palpatine and led a group of fallen Jedi in search of the sacred place. He was ultimately struck down by the neophyte Jedi Kyle Katarn. Because Mira Lukans were so similar to humans, they could in fact interbreed. Such was the case of Kurin Jadre, the leader of the Covenant faction of Jedi and mother of Lucien Dre, during the Mandalorian Wars. Kurinda was half Mira Lukan, born of a human mother and a Mira Lukan Jedi father.
Ichani and Theresians. Similar to humans in every way, except for their pale skin, white hair, and silver eyes, Ichani all looked alike to one another, and siblings would appear indistinguishable to outsiders. The Ichani were a matriarchal society that revolved around combat, often expressing and communicating through violence or simulated combat rituals. The Ichani were known for their prowess as both strategists and generals, as well as hand-to-hand fighters, also developing a plethora of unique close quarters and bladed weapons and armor, usually of a lightweight design. Because of their kinetic forms of communication, Ichani could read the emotions of others, though subtle body movements and combat forms. Ichani martial arts were so effective, the Empire's Royal Guard and Imperial Intelligence Service trained in these combat techniques. The Ichani considered Mandalorians as rivals, as both groups held strong, militant warrior cultures. The Threesians were a subspecies or bi species of the Achani, who presented physically as diametric opposites to the Achani, with dark hair and dark skin. They were a patriarchal society, though they were no less fond of combat and favored heavier weapons and armor, and focused on a more brutal martial art than the fluid and fast Achani fighting forms. Thracians engaged in a form of sun worship in contrast to the Achani lunar worship, and the two societies were known to war with each other. The Thracians were known as fierce warriors and developed a cult of elite warriors known as the Sun Guard, whose weapons and armor would later influence the look of Palpatine's royal guards and even served Palpatine's predecessors as hired bodyguards and mercenaries. They had also been used as clone templates for stormtroopers and elite imperial units. Both the Achani and Thracians were thought to have originated as Arcanian experimentation on the human genome, and may explain the similarities between siblings. Some notable Achani were Brianna, who had served the Jedi Master Atriss before becoming a companion to Meteor Sirik and Rask Tos Su, a battlemaster for Jedi Lord Hoth's Army of Light. Thanks for flying with us. Jordan here. Just wanted to let everyone know what's happening here at the Star Lores podcast. Star Lores is now on Discord. If you would like to join the Star Lores Cantina Discord server, you can find a link in the description or on any of our social media accounts. Reach out with a DM or email. We'd love to hear from you. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter by searching the Star Lores podcast. Go ahead and give our page a like and send us a message. You can also email at starlorespodcast@gmail.com. Send us your fan art, Star Wars collections, or fan fictions, and you may even get a feature on one of our pages or even the show. Don't be afraid to offer corrections or add to any of the topics that we discuss on the show. We are also on Patreon, so if you want to help us pay the bills, as well as get a few awesome perks like bonus episodes, access to the private Facebook group, or the VIP section of the Discord server, head on over to patreon.com/StarLores and sign up for as little as $1 a month. And finally, make sure to subscribe to us on your favorite podcatcher app or YouTube, as well as sending us a 5-star review on iTunes. This really helps us reach a wider audience. Enjoy the rest of the show.
Everybody, welcome aboard the Millennial Falcon. This is Christian.
This is Jordan.
And today we are talking about near humans. But before we get too into our conversation about that, I just quickly want to go back and make a minor correction to our last episode. I'm a little bit of a history nerd, and I feel really dumb for making this error. But just wanted to mention that Franz Ferdinand was not the emperor. I think I referred to him as the emperor, but he was just the heir apparent.
Yes.
The Austro-Hungarian Empire. But
his death still...
all the other stuff still mattered. I just mistitled him. So that I just had to get that off my chest before someone listened to that and thought...
Thank you. I was very triggered.
Yeah. Apology not accepted. All right. Let's talk about near humans. Now, first things first, I want to get this out of the way. We did not, by any measure, even scratch the surface of the number of near humans that are out there.
Yeah.
You might
also, just like our galactic corporation.
Yes. There are so many.
You couldn't even possibly.
Yeah. So I just picked the minor sampling. I'll give you kind of a rationale why I picked the species that I did. But before that, I do want to mention some of the more notable near human species, I think, also deserve their own episodes as well. So if we didn't cover your favorite near human species, don't add us. We will likely either get to them or mention them in another group episode if there's not enough info on them, or if they're individually like worth talking about, like Twi'leks or Zabrax, they're definitely going to get their own episode. So just hang in there. Or the Chiss or the Hapens, all notable groups that I even started writing some of them into this episode. And I just thought it was too long. So
I feel like some species do need their own episode.
Yeah, exactly. So don't, like I said, don't add us. We know this isn't by any measure the entirety of the near humans that exist.
Yeah.
So even the concept of near humans is interesting because they're not always distinct aliens. Like they have some kind of genetic lineage, either like ancient humans that kind of evolved on a different world due to environmental pressures just evolving separately or differently. Some cases that line does get blurred, and that just is like the definition of near human is blurry sometimes. So they could, someone could be a completely distinct alien species just as much as a human offshoot that has evolved into itself.
So was it, correct me if I'm wrong, but aren't like Rhodians considered near humans too?
I don't know if Rhodian specifically, but there are some that you would think that are...
You would think are humanoids.
Yeah. Celestians, for sure. Celestians are considered near humans. If you know, I forgot his name off the top of my head, but he's the co-pilot of the Millennium Falcon when they're attacking the second Death Star with Lando.
Okay, yeah.
He's got like the weird fins on his face.
Yeah, yeah.
Neonub.
Yeah.
So they're considered near humans too, but they look definitely...
I do remember reading there are near humans that look...
Very alien.
They look very alien.
Yeah, so the lines are very blurry, and like in that case, like you could believe maybe they had a genetic lineage or parentage of humanity, but they just had such strong environmental pressures that just morphed them so differently.
Yeah.
But like I said, the definitions are blurry, so the lines are blurry. So
I mean, to be a little fair in sort of reality, like sometimes biology
is blurry.
It is very blurry about when something.
Yeah, humans like nice clean categorizations, and biology doesn't always like to work with us on that. And speciating and like, is this even, and even within humanity, right? Like you have, could it just be a distinct cultural group rather than its own species? Is it still human, right?
Yeah.
And then you mix in the fact like some of them can interbreed with humans and have like human hybrid children, right? So,
yeah. It seems to me like many near humans, are for all intents and purposes basically
humans.
Human, just like a variation of a human, right?
Yeah. And even that, with that, like just culturally different, but still, you know, human in essence and genetics. So yeah, the lines are definitely blurry. Let's talk about the ones that we talked about. Well, actually, before we delve into the specifics, let's kind of touch on the whole near human thing in sci-fi in general. You'll notice with Star Wars and Star Trek and a lot of these, you know, space IPs, aliens tend to look a lot like humans, right?
Right.
They might have like different brow ridges or different skin colors that aren't found in the...
Yeah, there's almost like a human bias that's put into the creation of aliens.
And obviously the practical explanation is it's a lot cheaper to glue some horns on a bald guy than it is to come up with completely...
Yeah, some prosthetic ears are like...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Then completely, you know, rebuilding the human form from scratch.
Yeah.
But there are some real life, I guess, conversations that we can have around the idea of alien species kind of looking human-like.
Yeah, I was actually recently reading The Cosmos by Carl Sagan, the book. He wrote it after the TV show in the 80s came out. But he was sort of speculating on what alien life would look like in our galaxy or other galaxies. And he strongly criticized properties like Star Wars and Star Trek, saying that like there's no way they would look like that. We couldn't possibly predict what they would look like. The fact that they would be like bipedal,
two eyes, a nose, and a mouth, and
like that's it. And he said like He said, probably we can't even like imagine what they would look like. And I'm not sure if we even mentioned in previous episodes, but there are some sci-fi properties that sort of get really imaginative with aliens. And one of those is Arrival.
Yeah.
Based on the short story called The Story of Your Life. But Arrival gets it, like, it's a very different take on, you know, an alien species. But I think other, like, even Spider-Man with, like, Venom, right? Like, that's an alien
species.
Symbiote. Yeah, the symbiote is an alien species, right? And it is very different than anything.
It's like a living goo.
Yeah, exactly. Which is a kind of conceptually kind of interesting, right?
So, yeah.
But it is very difficult, I think, for, like, people who are writing aliens or writing about aliens to, like, break out of the mold of anthropomorphizing them, you know?
Yeah, and then especially if you're saying working through a creative medium where you want to relate to these aliens in some capacity, it's obviously a lot easier to relate to something that resembles humanity in some regard rather than come in total form.
And the funny thing, too, is if we're like, okay, I'm going to get real creative, often what people do is they just go to another animal
that we know. It's still an Earth-based creature. Yeah.
You know, it's like a dog or an ape, like,
or I find a lot of people go underwater because that at least is a little different. Right. You see a lot of squids in space.
Yeah, yeah, crustaceans.
Yeah.
And whatnot. So, yeah, it is. I thought this episode is kind of interesting, looking at near humans, just like how would they come about. I know, like, a lot of properties also have different explanations.
Yeah, this is almost like a retroactive explanation, like, oh, they all look like human because obviously they used to be humans a long time ago.
So, funny thing, I've been, like, slowly going through, like, all the Star Trek series, and
I think it's time for another podcast.
But it's funny, especially in the original series and the Next Generation, they run into so many species that I think it was just the producers were too lazy to make them look alien. And so they basically looked exactly like humans and spoke English.
Yeah.
And you know,
every other barrier that
like they're completely indistinguishable, but we had never met this species before. Right. Like, and so, like, from what I've read, I haven't gotten this far yet, but Gene Roddenberry sort of, like, wants to, like, fill in that plot hole later on and basically makes up, like, you know, millennia and millennia ago, there was a human-like species that sort of seeded the galaxy with all these species that would basically end up looking very similar.
Yeah, I was actually about to mention that's sometimes a trope that sci-fi uses is kind of a higher power creator that like is the origin point, and that is also why.
So Stargate does this. It's the same thing.
And so does 40K too. Yeah. Where you have one originator species.
A progenitor species.
Exactly. Yeah, that seeds the galaxy, and that's why all sentient life kind of has vague similarities. Sometimes they get pretty crazy. But other
I think it's often when all these species are created, like in the drawing room, they don't actually think about that until later.
And right till it's filming day and they're like, slap this on your face.
No, like years later, even after it's already come out and being like, oh yeah, this kind of makes no sense.
Yeah.
And like I said, with Gene Roddenberry, with like every species basically speaking the same, he sort of came up with an idea. Oh, like the when someone's talking to someone, their communicators on their chest are actually translating it, right? Yeah. That was like how he filled in that plot hole. Yeah. How everyone magically speaks English, right? So there's like all sorts of things they kind of come up with
retroactively
after the fact.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I just thought it's kind of funny. And I think probably Star Wars suffers from that a little bit too.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Anything that was made in the 80s is science fiction for sure. Yeah.
But Star Wars was better with, like, actually everyone spoke different languages.
Yeah, least, and even, know? Like, you have, like, shots, like, in the cantina where you see just, like, a plethora of different aliens.
It's true, yeah.
Sure, they have the general template of, like, two eyes, a nose, and a mouth, but there were real attempts made at making them look genuinely alien, right?
Yeah.
So,
Especially with like Jabba the Hutt and stuff.
Yeah, and then you get into some crazy stuff.
Sentient. Who's still like the nose, mouth, and two eyes and two arms, but like.
But now he's a slug.
Yeah. But yeah, largely a slug.
I will mention, and I do believe we did mention this on a previous episode as well, is the idea of like convergent evolution, where you have an optimization of sorts that happens, or like this just seems to be the best way to do a certain task.
Yeah.
And so, like, functionally, you know, a limb or a system will develop similarly or the same in two completely distinct people creatures.
Or different species.
That will functionally do the same thing because it just happens to be the best way to do that thing.
The
or the same environmental pressures produce the same result. Yeah, yeah. So in that logic, you could have a similar thing where like similar, you know, a creature that lives in a very similar environment to Earth might look a lot like Earth creatures. Now, keep in mind, Earth creatures have a very wide breadth of what that could look like, right?
Yeah.
But that is still also a way to kind of explain things. And I even think we mentioned this as well, but I'm going to throw it out there anyways, that it seems that turning into crabs seems to be the optimized solution. Crabs are the optimum species.
And lobsters, They've been relatively the same for, you know, millions of years.
But I think they ran a bunch of tests and they're like, crabs are the future. Because you have things like sharks too and crocodiles who have been the same since forever as well. Yeah. And they seem to have optimized their niches.
Yeah.
I think sharks are older than trees. So.
Wow.
Yeah. Fun fact. Anyways, kind of zeroing in, I guess, and then on the species that we talked about specifically here. I just wanted to kind of give a little bit of a logic as to why we picked the species we did. You'll notice that a few of them are more dominant in the Old Republic era, which is kind of the era we've been in for the last few episodes. So I just kind of wanted to give a broader context to some of the other side characters that you might encounter either through the games of Knights of the Old Republic or through the comic books, like the Achani, the Miraluka, and even the Arcanians play a pretty significant plot point in Zane Carrick's story. So that's kind of why I wanted to tie them in together here. But like I said, there are so many, and we'll likely do another little episode like this and pick another kind of shooting gallery of different species to look at. In particular, just kind of going over the groups that we did choose, the Bim are interesting. I thought they resembled something like either dwarves, but their life style and everything else about them actually makes me think of hobbits, space hobbits. They're very like peaceful, in tune with nature.
Yeah.
Kind of like Shire life mentality. So I think the Bims are more like space hobbits than anything. And they come from an older, I think it was a comic book publication for Star Wars.
Okay.
And they seem to be a bit of a throwaway species. So like they're not very involved with galactic politics.
But those are the best.
Yeah.
The throwaways are like.
Sometimes you get like really dumb things that are just like, why? Or you'll get replications, I find. For throwaways, they're like, they didn't do the research. So they created an entirely new alien species that already existed.
Right.
Or will mess with backstory of a species not knowing that they already had a backstory, right? I think that kind of comes up with Zabrax. I think they have a couple of origin stories that people two people kind of decided to write about them, and then they had to find a way to retroactively realign their backstories, which they ultimately have done, but we'll get into that in a Zabrak episode. I know I'm going to get flack for not including Zabrax in this. Well, it's too bad. The other group I want to talk about are the Arcanians, who are almost like space elves. They remind me a lot of elves from, not like the traditional Tolkien elves, but elves from the Elder Scrolls. They have like very strong like racial supremacy type views. They think themselves superior to others.
Yeah.
They kind of remind me of Eldar from 40K in the sense that like they're just so intelligent and beyond typical abilities of human-like creatures that like, and their genetic tamperings and creating all these like subspecies as like servant classes.
They seem very, utilitarian perhaps, like that's sort of their moral compass is just,
I wouldn't even say they're utilitarian, because at least a utilitarian can like, if they deem an equation to be and have a negative outcome, they might be self-sacrificial, you know, like if I remove myself from the equation, whereas the Arcanians are more self-interested.
I suppose.
I don't think an Arcanian would sacrifice itself for the sake of others.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
No, but like they don't think of any large, it seems like they don't think of any larger sort of ethical questions.
Yeah, definitely. Well, but that comes from a sense of superiority rather than...
That is true, but as long as it benefits their species.
Their
right?
species,
like,
yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
It is a form of utilitarianism, I guess.
Yeah, but that's all I'm saying. Is they're sort of,
I just call it extreme self-interest. Yeah. But yeah, yeah. And yeah, it's funny. Well, not funny. It's horrible. But they like will manipulate the genetics of other people, other species, without right. them even knowing that they're being tampered with.
Yeah.
Which incidentally leads to things like the Achani and the other group. I forget what they're called.
Oh yeah,
they're mirrored.
Yeah, the mirror ones.
Yeah,
I don't remember what they were called either.
Yeah,
yeah.
But yeah, it's they. They do a lot of bad stuff. I should also note here that just because a general species might act a certain way doesn't mean every individual does.
Sure.
That's xenophobic. Don't do that. But they do have broad cultural or genetic patterns that obviously, like, this is what the typical
right, yeah.
Species might act like. But you always find exceptions. Like, same with the Arcanians, there's that Jedi Master who was, like, a renowned Jedi for his time, and he obviously wasn't practicing unethical biological experiments on people, and he used his, you know... superhuman abilities for good rather than the advancement of his own species at the cost of others. We'll likely be revisiting some of these species in other forms, either through different characters that are pretty prevalent. Again, the Achani and the Miraluka come to mind. They have some pretty big figures like Jarek from the Jedi Knight games.
Yeah.
He's the main antagonist. And then also with Visus Mars, who is also a significant party member from the KOTOR games. And same with Brienne of the Achani. And the Achani have a lot more to offer to you with their fighting style and stuff. So just keep those kind of filed away in the back of your mind. We'll definitely be revisiting them in the near future. But while we're here, it's the Thyresians. They're the mirror of the Achani. I just wanted to mention with them, there's a very cool... So the Sun Guard... are very cool. I didn't know if I'd ever get a chance to talk about them. If you look up a picture of them, there's only one picture that I know of. And they essentially look like the Emperor's Royal Guards with the red robes. But they have more of like a Mandalorian T-visor. And they have like more tactical equipment on them.
Hmm.
But they're very cool looking. I love their backstory.
Do you know where did they first appear?
Oh, I didn't check.
Okay, yeah. Fair enough.
I might go back and on our next episode might have to drop it in there. Yeah. But they are very cool, and it's cool how they tie into, like, you know, we'll definitely be doing a Royal Guard episode too, where this will likely come up again, but it's cool that their like influence is seen on how Palpatine's guards look, as well as I mentioned, they used to be bodyguards and mercenaries for Palpatine's predecessors as recently as Palpatine's master and master before that, Darth Tenebris and, Plagueis, yeah. So it was until very recently, which is why obviously Palpatine would choose to model his personal bodyguards after.
Yeah. I do like that there's sort of like, they're giving sort of texture to everything that you see in the films.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's actually like
there's a reason
story
for it. Yeah.
Behind it. Yeah.
Yeah. And one thing people might think, which I mean, two things can be true at once as well, is like, yeah, the Emperor's Royal Guards obviously do have some resemblance to the Senate guards, and again we'll do our whole bit on them as well, but yeah, it's a cool kind of overlapping area that I wanted to mention. I really like them. I think they're very cool. I'd like to see more of them in the future but I want to see them in the Legends context, so I don't think my dream will ever be realized.
They'll bring it back. They'll make it canon again.
You have a lot of
multiverse. Disney loves the multiverse.
Yeah, that's true. Sell double the product.
They'll do it.
Yeah. Other than that, did you have any other thoughts on our near human counterparts?
No, I think we're good.
All right. Well, like I said, we'll likely revisit this topic again with another kind of round table of different species we'll have selected, and then like I said, keep your ears out for the big episodes on like the species that definitely deserve their own kind of breakdown of their culture and society, and like there's so much information on them that they really deserve their own deep dive.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, I guess we'll just jump into hyperspace here.
Yep.
Engage.